From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, award-winning filmmaker and Milwaukee native John Ridley talks about the new creative hub that he's creating here.
Then chemotherapy can be a lifesaver, but it takes a toll on a person's body.
Chemotherapy works. And there's not going to be any time soon where we're going to stop giving people chemotherapy because we're worried about the side effects of the drugs. So we need to find a way to deal with the chemo brain symptoms because they're happening regardless.
Then concert pianist and Carthage College faculty member Wael Farouk prepares to play all 5 Beethoven concertos in one evening.
Initially wanted to do 3, and I said, well, why not do all 5? So the more intriguing is just to find someone as crazy as I am and agreeing to do it. You know, it's a great opportunity. I consider myself very lucky.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Last month, Oscar-winning filmmaker and Milwaukee native John Ridley formally unveiled plans to bankroll a new for-profit creative hub. The organization will be housed in an old Pabst Brewery building on West McKinley Avenue.
That's a part of downtown that is seeing growth and redevelopment already, with new condos and other multi-use spaces. Ridley Space, which is called No Studios, is a business venture with Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley. The 3-story, 40,000-square-foot facility will feature a 50-seat screening room, food and beverage services, galleries, and a rooftop event space.
The idea is to give artists of all sorts the chance to showcase their talent, no matter what that art background might be. Clients can sign long or short-term leases, and Milwaukee Film, 371 Productions, and the UWM School of Film are among those already on board.
I caught up with Ridley after the press conference last month to learn more.
You know, I love Milwaukee. It's my birth city. It's where I'm from. It's one of those interesting, eclectic places. You know, you say Milwaukee to people and they go, I've never been to Milwaukee. I'm like, how have you never been to Milwaukee? It's one of those places that I don't know, and I can only speak because this is the only birthplace I know. It just never really leaves you. And what it was about and the experiences I had here, wanting to make sure that every individual from Milwaukee who might dream about being a storyteller, an artist, or a filmmaker doesn't just have to dream about it and figure out what is that roadmap from here to there. That, to me, it became sort of a driver. I think the more I went out in the world and fewer people knew about Milwaukee, knew about the city, knew about the kinds of folks that were here, the only thing they really were aware of were Laverne and Shirley. It was like, you know, I want people to understand the values, the fact that just Wisconsin in general has always been a very progressive place. You know, there is a city, there are always problems and challenges, but this is a very progressive city, it's a very progressive state. And if I had the opportunity, you know, look, I've lived in New York and Los Angeles and London. I can't really make a huge difference in those places. I can be a good citizen and try to be a responsible person. I think that's very important for all of us to do. But to come back to Milwaukee and know that you can really make a difference here and you can partner with individuals who see the value in what you're trying to do, that was very important to me as well.
What is it about growing up here, do you think, that has informed your own art? Because you're both a writer and a filmmaker.
I am a writer first, and I think I've tripped into being a filmmaker and wanting to tell stories. I think it was being in a space where it was very open-minded, but at the same time, I did not have the opportunity to cross-pollinate with a lot of different demographics. I think I was always encouraged to have a worldview, but didn't always have to have that worldview tested. And I think that's one of the interesting things, is to be in a place where you're encouraged to think and you're encouraged to experience. And it is a city of festivals, but it is still a very tight demographic. And then to go out in the world and say there were a lot of really terrific values that were instilled in me that came from a lot of different places, but having those values instilled and having those values tested is a whole other thing. So to come back and try to encourage people and say, hey, the values that you're getting here are really terrific values, but are we putting them to work here in Milwaukee? Are we putting them into effect here? You know, there are a lot of things about Milwaukee that I wasn't aware of in terms of the city being segregated in many ways, having real socioeconomic divides. You know, my experience is not everyone's experience. And saying, hey, if I can make it, that's really a terrific thing, but am I doing everything to ensure that the things that I think that are wonderful about Milwaukee, they're not just my experience, they're experiences that can be shared by anyone and should be shared by everyone who wants to be a participant in their own better lives.
How do you see this space, once it opens, the No Studios, how do you see that space helping to do that? Are you reaching out to individuals? Are you looking at people who have already got small production companies? You know, who are you aiming this toward?
All of that. We are certainly, for our long-term tenants, we're aiming at individuals who have production companies, who are up and running, who want a space that is more dedicated to their profession and understands their needs and their desires. We are certainly moving towards the educational spaces. We're partnering with the local universities, and education really is a very important component, because it's one thing certainly to get that classroom education, very important to have those fundamentals, but are those students exposed to real-world education and individuals who are working outside of the Milwaukee area and can hopefully talk to them about what their expectations could be or should be as they move out into the larger entertainment or creative spaces. We certainly want to direct it towards individuals who've been traditionally disenfranchised and may think that the arts isn't something for them or something that they could obtain, to know that whether it's talkbacks or screenings or exhibitions or what have you, if you just have a general interest, you know, you're invited. You may not know what you want to do yet in the arts, but you have an affinity towards it. Or as I said in the presentation, you know, if you're a senior designer, if you like working with costumes or wardrobe or what have you, those are all parts of the artistic endeavor as well. It's not just the writers, it's not just the actors or the directors. Almost any job that's out there can be applied in some way to the artistic and creative spaces. And then most importantly, the patrons. You know, we want to make sure that people who patronize, if they want to be involved in some way, if they have an interest, if we have special screenings, if we have special events, you know, throughout the history of arts, it's been those who have supporting those who want to achieve and want to express and need that support.
Oh, I think audience is that other piece that so often gets forgotten, because if you don't have somebody watching it, listening to it, seeing
It's a tree falling in the woods.
Exactly.
And you look at things that are going on out there. You know, people ask me, how do I feel about Black Panther or Wonder Woman, Lady Bird, or all of those films that have a cultural density? That's terrific. You know, I love telling stories too, but if I'm telling these stories for myself, it's not really a mover. So in all of these spaces and all of these ways, it really is about bringing together these disparate communities and saying, you all need to know each other and you all can benefit from knowing each other. And there is an excitement and there's an enthusiasm. What we want to do is keep that going.
What was the thought behind making this a for-profit rather than nonprofit? I mean, most of the people in the arts are used to the nonprofit model.
Yeah, and most of those people are also, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, they're used to people coming to them and asking for donations or writing grants. I think one of the issues has been over time that, particularly I think when you're talking about regional storytellers, how do you get money? How do you get funding? It's grants. It's going to people for funding. It's looking for donations. That's all terrific. I really don't want to disparage that model, but we don't want to come into a space and be disruptive for other individuals who are already looking for grants, who are looking for money, who are looking for people who are supporting through donations, particularly in the Milwaukee area where that space, it may be limited. And also not necessarily having a bulwark or a rainy day sense of how we're operating. You know, if you're looking for grants and donations, you know, if the economy hits tough times, you know, everybody's looking for a smaller pool. In a for-profit space, like any other business, we certainly got to be responsible. But with a business, you're looking at the good days, you're looking at the bad days, you're looking at how are we over time sustaining ourselves. So we're not trying to reach into anybody else's pocket. We want to make sure that we're looking at what we're doing and making sure that every single day we have something that incentivizes everybody, no matter who you are or where you're from, to come and participate, but knowing that if we are generating a profit, part of that is going back into the good work that we want to be able to do. I mean, for me, you know, as profitable as this may be, this is not going to be, you know, it is not going to be the profit driver the way it is when I'm working at Disney or I'm working at Sky or Showtime or doing those other things.
This isn't your retirement.
This is not my retirement, but knowing that the other things that I'm doing in my life can sustain this and support this and provide an enthusiasm towards this, then I know that we're doing the right thing.
So when this gets going, in the perfect universe, what does it look like for you? What do you want to see happening in this space?
I would love to be able to walk into the space and, you know, from the beginning of the day, seeing people come in who are working with purpose. Later in the day, see people socializing with purpose. And as the day progresses, knowing that we have the potential to have screenings or exhibitions, to have a third space for people who are involved or interested in the arts in some fashion. It really is for us about socializing with purpose. And that's been a big part of my career. And I think one of the things when people think about writers, you know, they're off in a coffee shop or cafe, you know, drinking, smoking, angry individuals. But a lot of that is knowing that you're around people who are going to be supportive, that can look at your work and give you an honest assessment of what you're doing, that you're not alone, that you really, you know, you're not becoming a hermit with your work. You're out somewhere where you can see how people interact. You can listen to their dialogue, how they talk. You know, that's what we want to do with this space, is know that people are socializing with purpose. So we have long-term tenants. We have short-term tenants who are coming in and maybe working on a project. We have a screening room. So when people have a project, you know, where do I go? Where do I screen? You know, we're, it's not a big enough film, perhaps, for the Oriental Theater. But I want to get some feedback on it, or I want to have a special screening. We have that capacity. And then we have an event space up top where people can come and, you know, if they want to bring people in, or if they want to have a launch event, if they want to just bring folks in to talk about what they're doing, we have those spaces within the hub.
And are you going to be bringing any of your work here to show?
I certainly hope so. Last year when we had Let It Fall, we ended up doing several screenings here and we did not have a space, so I'd love to screen it here. I hope and believe that certainly, you know, you talked about the differences between my two careers. I hope that the work that I do out in Hollywood or wherever, we actually don't shoot that much in Hollywood, wherever we're shooting, that work can come and can be exhibited here, shown here, bring some of my famous friends here. It really is incumbent upon me in the next couple of years to do as much work as I possibly can to help support this business here. You know, at this point, the no space, I think it's terrific space, it's still a lost leader for me. So I've got to go out and do as much as I can to try to support this space, because it's of emotional, educational, intellectual value to me to make this work. So yes, the short answer to your question is whatever I'm doing out there, I certainly will be trying to bring here.
John Ridley, thank you so much.
Absolutely, thank you.
John Ridley is an award-winning filmmaker and a Milwaukee native. His No Studios is scheduled to open this fall in the Old Pabst Brewery. We spoke with him last month at a press conference here in Milwaukee.
We'll take a short break now, and then we learn about pioneering research coming out of Milwaukee about the effects chemotherapy has on cognition. That is when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Chemotherapy is, in some ways, a medical miracle. It's proven to kill cancer, and every year, hundreds of thousands of Americans are helped by these drugs.
But it also has many known side effects. Perhaps the most noticeable is hair loss, but different kinds of chemotherapy can lead to life-altering consequences.
Infertility, nerve damage, and anemia are just a few of the many side effects that can come from chemo. Well, now a growing body of work is focusing on yet another issue that's caused by these drugs, colloquially known as chemo brain.
Dr. Adam Greenberg is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, and his lab just received a grant that funds two studies on the effects of chemotherapy on brain functionality. Adam, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Just to start off here, what is chemo brain?
Well, that is really what this study is about. It's really hard to define chemo brain. In large part, it's defined by people coming back to their oncologist after chemotherapy and simply saying, I don't feel quite right. There's a whole range of ways in which this gets brought to the attention of a physician. Generally speaking, it's some sort of cognitive problem. So it's often – people often think of it as an attention-related problem, although there are people who have language issues, people who have motor control issues, all kinds of – it can come out in various ways.
Is chemo brain right now, is it considered a legitimate side effect of chemotherapy? Is it recognized by most physicians?
Recognized by most physicians, yes. As far as I know, there is no official – diagnosis of chemo brain, probably because there's no specific treatment for chemo brain. And so I think the issue is certainly all oncologists who directly treat patients with chemotherapy or prescribe chemotherapy know about chemo brain, and most of them are warning their patients at this point about the effects that we would call chemo brain. The issue really is they really don't have a lot of options for how to deal with chemo brain. I mean, the real problem, of course, and this is a problem in a weird sense, is that chemotherapy works. And there's not going to be any time soon where we're going to stop giving people chemotherapy because we're worried about the side effects of the drugs. So we need to find a way to deal with the chemo brain symptoms because they're happening regardless, because chemotherapy does help with cancer.
Beyond not having a way to deal with it, do we know right now, do we have a good idea of how long chemo brain lasts?
So that is something that has been studied ever so slightly. There's a little bit of evidence in the literature, but it's, as usual, when we're at the beginning of the discovery of these things, it's a little bit conflicting. So there have been some studies that have shown that chemo brain symptoms are strongest directly after chemotherapy ends or during the chemo treatment itself, depending on how long you're having chemo. And then they tend to go away for a little while. Some have discovered that after 6 months, there's a bit of a decline in the chemo brain symptoms, so a recovery of normal function. Some people have shown that it takes 2 years. But then others have shown you get a slight decline out at the 2 to 3 year mark. We would call that in science a U-shaped function, where you have a lot of chemo brain symptoms right after chemotherapy. They maybe get a little bit better in the, say, 1 to 2 year range, and then they actually get worse again beyond that. And there's a study that was published, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, that was done with people who had chemotherapy treatment 20 years prior. So it's a really long ago treatment population. And those individuals still showed cognitive decline symptoms compared to their breast cancer with no chemo counterparts. So this can last, I mean, if you believe that particular study, it can last 20 years or more. So I guess the short answer is it's very complicated at this point, and it's simply because we haven't studied it enough.
How long have people been studying chemo brain? How long has this been on the radar of researchers?
That's a great question. It's certainly the case that it has gained some steam in the last 2 to 3 years. But the term chemo brain, I know, is more of a recent term. Based strictly on the dates of studies that have been published, there have been people who have been studying this for 10 or more years. But only recently has there been this larger interest, and importantly, outside of the oncology neuropsychology community. So neuropsychologists are clinical psychologists who have batteries of standardized tests that are normalized across many different patient groups. And those are the most common ways of testing people for any kind of cognitive deficit that's seen in the clinic. And in fact, that's what happens when a patient returns to their oncologist and says, I'm having some memory trouble, or I'm having some language trouble, or I'm having some focusing trouble. The doctor says, okay, well, you might have chemo brain. I'm going to send you to our local neuropsychologist. And they give them a battery of tests. And they, sure enough, they say, yeah, you have a working memory problem, or yeah, you have an attention problem. But then that's kind of where it ends. The reason that I think it has gotten a little bit of press outside of the neuropsychology world more recently is because of the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. About a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, they put out a call for grant proposals specifically from the neuroscience community for people like myself who are interested in the neural mechanisms of normal behavior, trying to use what we've learned in normal behavior to try to understand what might be happening with these chemo brain individuals.
So you have two studies, impending studies. Tell me about the first one.
Yeah, I mean, they're very closely related, but the first one is what we would call a strictly behavioral study. So there's no real neuroscientific measures that we're using. And that study is aimed at trying, at least in our mind, to get sort of a lay of the land. Both of the studies are longitudinal, which is something that has been sorely needed in this particular field. So in this first study, we're identifying individuals who are ready to have their chemotherapy treatment. So they've been told by their oncologist that they're going to have chemo treatment, but they haven't yet begun. So we have to catch them in this very narrow window, which often winds up being 3 days, maybe 5 days. So we have very tight, very close communication with the oncologist that we work with. Once we get them scheduled, we test them for about an hour on a variety of behavioral tasks. So these are either paper and pencil tasks. Those are standard neuropsychological tests like the ones I was talking about a few moments ago. Or we've also implemented some tests from cognitive neuroscience, from cognitive psychology on iPads. And so they just run as little apps and we have our research assistants talking to the patients and they work through some of the tasks. They're all reaction time tasks, meaning that the subject will see something on the screen and then they're asked to press a button on the screen as quickly and as accurately as they can. We have some tests that measure visual attention and other tests that measure auditory attention. So we're looking in multiple modalities for signs of cognitive decline. So that happens in the first session. Then they go through their chemotherapy regimen. That can take 3 months, can take 6 months or longer. Once they're finished, we're in close communication again with the oncologist, so we know. Our goal is within about a month, but hopefully more like a week to 2 weeks after their last chemo session, we try to get in touch with them and have them come back to our lab and do effectively the same procedures that we ran through before they started chemotherapy. And the idea here is to try to understand what the profile, behavioral profile of cognitive decline is in individuals who ultimately wind up having these chemo brain symptoms. So when we test these people at the beginning, before they start their chemo treatment, we don't know who's going to be in the chemo brain group and who's not, and who's going to be in the control group. They will effectively tell us by telling us about the symptoms that they wind up having after they finish their chemotherapy.
So you have another study that seems to build off directly from the first study, except it involves brain scans.
That's right. We're going to be doing neuroimaging with an MRI scanner. This is something we do in my lab all the time, but we usually look at normal volunteers, not patients. In this particular case, we're replicating the first study. We may change some of the metrics that we use based on what we find in the first study, but we're essentially replicating the behavioral data from the first study. But what we're adding is a neuroimaging piece to this. So we can not only identify the ways in which people have lost some cognitive abilities, but we can also try to understand what the brain mechanisms are that are the reason for that decline.
When you are looking at these brain scans, when you're doing this neural imaging, are you looking for lesions? Are you looking for brain activity?
Yeah, we're looking for patterns of activity, not lesions. We don't expect there to be lesions from chemotherapy. But there seems to be some indication in the literature that there are changes in the function of the brain in certain areas that are responsible for various cognitive operations. But also there's a change in the connectivity pattern. So how information flows from one area of the brain to another area of the brain. That's our real key interest in this particular study, is to look at the brain regions that are involved in a particular cognitive operation, say visual attention, and then measure how that information flows from those regions to one another, back and forth, both before they begin chemotherapy and then after they end chemotherapy. And by looking at the difference in how the connections may change, we think we'll hopefully get a chance to tap into the selective issues that come from cognitive decline from chemotherapy.
Do we know right now what it is about chemotherapy that would cause this kind of cognitive decline?
In short, the answer is no. I mean, I can give you a very general
overview of the sort of state of the field, but it's kind of in flux. The thought is that there are certain neurotoxins that are at play that while they may help in certain aspects with respect to killing or removing cancer cells, they also target parts of the brain that are involved in cognitive operations that affect our daily life. There have been some animal studies. There have been some studies with humans with oncologists who use different combinations of drugs for chemotherapy. And there's been some slight evidence that different combinations of chemotherapy may have more or less effect, but it's just far too early to make any kind of speculation about exactly where those particular effects may come from.
How does your work fit into the larger body of work that we're seeing come out about ChemoBrain?
So when we designed this study, we did a lot of searching in the literature to try to understand what the key aspects of the work that's being done already were lacking, you know, what was missing. And the main things that we came up with were most of the studies that are done, the vast majority, are done with people who have already finished their chemo treatment. And we're comparing individuals who maybe they're 6 months out, maybe they're a year out, maybe they're 10 years out, like the one we talked about a moment ago. But we're comparing individuals who had breast cancer who went through chemo treatment with individuals who had breast cancer who did not have chemo treatment. And occasionally, some studies will also have healthy controls who are basically age-matched individuals who didn't have any cancer at all. And obviously, they also didn't have any chemotherapy. Those studies are useful when you can characterize a lot about those individuals. In other words, the level of education and the specific issues that they may have had in terms of their cognitive decline directly after they finished chemotherapy. But what's lacking there is you're always going to be comparing across groups of individuals. So any effects that you wind up seeing between, say, the individuals who had chemotherapy and the individuals that did not could be due to just differences between those individuals. And so it's critical at this point to try to understand how ChemoBrain or how chemotherapy develops these issues over time within an individual. There's a side benefit to this, of course, which is you can study fewer people, so you can get these studies done a little bit faster. But the main issue was making sure that we do this longitudinally, in other words, to study people before chemo and then again after chemo. The other thing, and this is maybe the reason that I'm specifically involved, the other thing that we felt needed to be done was to bring to bear the collective knowledge that the world of cognitive psychology or cognitive science has with respect to human behavior, human cognition, really. As I said before, most of the research that's been done with respect to ChemoBrain have used neuropsychological metrics, so this standard battery of neuropsych tests. And those are useful, but they're designed for something very different. They're not designed for this kind of specific pinpointing of an ailment like what we're trying to do with ChemoBrain. They're designed to be very nonspecific, in fact, to be able to tell a physician or a neuropsychologist whether someone is having a working memory problem or an attention problem, or whether they're having a language problem or a motor control problem, but not to be able to tell you the specific type of cognitive decline that someone might have, knowing that they already have an attention problem. What exactly is the problem? The only way you can do that is with detailed reaction time or accuracy tests like we use in a cognitive psychology laboratory. And that's where my experience, I think, has helped with designing the study, because we're able to look at not just the neuropsychological side of things, but also the normal human behavior. We can tell differences between one condition and another that may wind up being 15 or 20 milliseconds. But if the statistics work out right, then we know that it's a real difference.
All right. Well, Adam, I'm looking forward to seeing more of your work. And thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adam Greenberg is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee. He's researching the effects of chemotherapy on the brain.
After a short break, we'll meet the Carthage College faculty member who will perform all 5 Beethoven piano concertos tonight. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Thank you.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Tonight at Carthage College in Kenosha, faculty member and concert pianist Wael Farouk will perform a concert called Beethoven, 5 Piano Concertos, 1 Pianist.
It's an almost superhuman feat. Each concerto is difficult enough on its own. So to find out why Farouk decided to schedule all 5 in one evening, audio engineer Jason Reavy and I took a drive to Kenosha.
When the idea was presented to me first by Kirk Muspratt, the conductor of the New Philharmonic Orchestra, I just could not resist. I believe he initially wanted to do 3, and I said, well, why not do all 5? So probably the more intriguing is just to find someone as crazy as I am and agreeing to do it. And you know, it's a great opportunity. I consider myself very lucky.
Thematically, these were written at different times in Beethoven's composing career. Mm. How did his compositional style change across these 5 concertos?
Mm. Well, as you well know, Beethoven was one of the most revolutionary characters, personalities, composers, artists really ever lived. And not only that, he himself changed a lot between numbers 1 through 5, but also the piano changed a lot, and it's a great map really to see from starting. You know, the first concerto is the second concerto. So the second concerto in B flat was written first around 1798 or so. And to see his use of the keyboard and even the range of the keyboard, and then you compare that to number 5, just the opening of number 5, it's really a new age. And there were maybe 11 or 12 years in between, so considerably, not a really long period of time, but he adapted, what he changed, what he implemented, what he invented musically and pianistically is quite amazing. So of course, coming up with new means, with new ways of expression, new technical patterns, new effects, not only for piano, of course, for the orchestra. And it's astonishing in many ways. And of course, what he had to say still on the piano continued through the sonatas, because, you know, the last concerto is Opus 73, but he wrote sonatas all the way up to Opus 111, and then the Diabelli Variations 120, and Bagatelles 126. So he still went on beyond those pieces.
Pushing the piano and pushing what it could do. Mm-hmm. In 1798, that was still forte piano, is that correct?
Right. He didn't really care very much for the Viennese piano, as Mozart did, for instance, or even Schubert. He was more attracted to the Broadwood English pianos. And that's part of the reason he adored Clementi and loved Clementi. And actually, surveying his musical library after he passed, there were very, very few works of his own piano music. There were only the score of Don Giovanni from Mozart, no piano works, and almost the entire works of Clementi for piano. And of course, Beethoven was always writing to piano manufacturers saying, I need more volume, I need more keyboard, I need more, you know, this is not projecting enough. So he was, as all great composers and then beyond, he was always ahead of his time, ahead of his instrument.
Is it fair to say that Beethoven really began the modern piano, what we consider the modern piano?
Absolutely fair to say that. I believe Clementi really planted those seeds in many ways. And if you compare Clementi's writing, especially the earlier ones, or what he did was the sonata form. But in terms of fame or well-known establishment, if you compare how many of Clementi's music played versus how many of Beethoven's music, of course, you know, sadly, it's not fair comparison. But Definitely, Beethoven set the stage on many, many things, and he established different level of pianistic splendor, really, or virtuosity. And Czerny, of course, picked this up, and he passed it on to Franz Liszt and the rest of the Romantics.
Could you give me a musical example of, say, something from that first concerto compared to something in the fifth concerto, and how it would have changed, you know, what shifted both musically and in terms of what the demand on the piano was?
I can perhaps compare the opening of both and maybe one or two things later on. So this is the opening of the C major concerto, or the published number one.
Classical.
Yes.
Yeah, you hear that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. You can say it's still in the time of Mozart. It's still in the affects and aesthetics of Mozart. And then now number five.
Can really in that one see, because I'm sitting next to you as you do this, and you're using so much more of the keyboard.
Right, and the pedal and the nuances, especially in the slow movements, as incredible those outer movements are, really to me, the slower movements are the significant ones. What he did with them was phrasing, was accompaniment, was usage of the pedal. He've gotten more adventurous and more curious and more revolutionary with the pedal, the more he could not hear. It's a very interesting connection. And you see more of that in the sonatas and, of course, in the on the concertos as well.
Can you give me a little sample of one of the slow movements?
Sure, sure. Maybe we can use both movements again of the first and the last concerto.
Thank you.
Ah, so stunningly beautiful. Again, the difference in those dozen years from what he was doing in that first one, where it was so much more classical, still very beautiful, but it's almost like that is his voice.
Yeah. Yeah,
when you get to that one.
Sure, sure. He's gotten more and more introverted in many ways. And he's, as you will know, around 1802, 1803, he actually contemplated suicide. And we have this heartbreaking note nicknamed the Heiligenstatue, where he wrote outside Vienna a letter to his brother, really saying there's nothing left for him in the world now. His deafness is complete and his loneliness is complete and his isolation. And how can he keep going except his faith in God and his faith in his art and his faith that he still need to tell people and share with his fellow humans. He always refer to people like that, what he has to say more about his art and what he feels still necessary. And that's what kept him going, even past the Ninth Symphony, past the late Beethoven sonatas, and we still have those amazing string quartets. He didn't really stop. It's beyond belief.
Do you think that that very humanness of mm-hmm. him, mm-hmm. the fact that he suffered so much, mm-hmm. that he was in agony mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. Do you think that's why we still relate to him, that he still has something to say to us?
Absolutely. And I think, so I always request from all of my students to really know more about the composer. These people are long dead in many ways. And what you see on the page, that black and white ink, really is nothing, is not the piece, is not the music, is not the composer in any fragments. Like Franz Liszt said, it's the duty of a performer to pick up the piece from the ground and breathe life into it every time they perform it. But Beethoven is definitely one of the greatest teachers as well. He can teach us so much about struggle, about triumph, about human faith and human will. And I guess that's in many ways what sums up his greatness. Of course, he was a great technician, a great composer. It's not a matter of sheer luck or accident that he have all those masterpieces after masterpieces. But I believe struggle and triumph, that's the one thing that characterizes Beethoven's music more than anything. And sometimes also he shows us, or he teaches us, really one of the first people to do that, that music is not just about beauty. It's about, yes, pain, it's about truth, and it's about picking up, you know, the pieces. And no matter the hardship or the obstacles seems to be, there is still hope and faith, and what you can do is beyond expectations.
There's something about, it's not that music didn't express those things mm-hmm. before Beethoven. Mm-hmm. I mean, you certainly listen to some of Mozart's things,
sure.
and it will make you cry,
right.
absolutely, yeah. or laugh, or, yeah. or whatever. But there was something about what he was doing, and as you said earlier, he, in the process of doing that, changed mm-hmm. Western music forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say Western culture too, not just the music, yes. He was very personal in many ways, and of course he learned a great deal from Mozart, even more perhaps from Haydn, and of course from Clementi, and he loved Bach, and he played Bach. That was one of the other scores in his library, the Wildtemperer Clavier, of course. And but he knew what he was, and he believed in art, and he was the one of the first people to refer to his work as my art. He refused to enter from the back door, even like Haydn or Mozart. He did not see himself a servant. He saw himself far more worthy of respect and fame even than royalty. He was incredibly witty as well, and a great sense of humor. And when people would introduce him to some of the nobility, and so-and-so would say, you know, prince, etc., landowner or whatever, and he will say Ludwig van Beethoven, brain owner or or a talent or something like that. So he really believed in himself and in his art, and, you know, that's another great lesson right there.
Do you have a favorite movement or piece within the five, or does that change depending on your mood?
No. Really, each one says something different, something special. However, I feel the slow movement of the fourth concerto that we were just talking about has more of a spiritual message in it, and that's just the simplicity really reflects the completeness of his loneliness in many ways and his isolation. I mean, it's nothing extravagant. It's the only movement, it's the only slow movement in a minor key. And it's the shortest slow movement, just 2.5 pages. It's, you know, nothing really.
Can you leave us with a little bit of that movement?
Sure.
But
sure.
Before you do, I want to say, Dr. Wael Farouk, it has been such an honor. Yeah. Thank you for playing for us, and best of luck with the concerts.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Professor Wael Farouk will present Beethoven 5 Piano Concertos 1 Pianist tonight at Carthage College in Kenosha, and twice over the weekend at College of DuPage in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. The new Philharmonic Orchestra is conducted by Kirk Muspratt, and there is more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk comes your way when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Mitch Tyke. When was the last time you went to the Milwaukee County Zoo? Did you get a chance to see the polar bear? Well, listener Jessica Oles was wondering about visits she had back in the early 80s and her interaction with the polar bears then.
I have vague memories of when I was little that you could feed marshmallows to the polar bears at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Everybody I talk to says I'm insane. There's no way the zoo would allow you to do that. It even, you know, in my mind, I think you're right. There's no way the zoo officials would allow people to just feed their animals marshmallows. But at the same time, it's such an absurd thing for me to come up with on my own that I'm convinced it had to have happened.
It does sound crazy, but it was a rare, beautiful spring morning the other day, so it seemed crazy not to go to the zoo's polar bear enclosure to look for the answer. Snow Lily was out, but she was asleep and she could not answer Jessica's question. There were a lot of little kids around as well, but I didn't want to put any ideas in their heads, so I retreated to the zoo administration annex, much quieter, inside the Northwestern Mutual Family Farm. That's where the zoo's library is and where I met...
I'm Mary Kazmierczak. I'm the librarian and information specialist for the Milwaukee County Zoo and the Zoological Society of Milwaukee.
You probably did not know the zoo had a library or a librarian, but that is a story for another Bubbler Talk. Mary knows a lot about the history of the Milwaukee County Zoo. Before she was the librarian, she was a Zoo Pride volunteer. And before she was a volunteer, she was a girl who grew up in Milwaukee and went to the zoo. Mary Kazmierczak, is it possible Jessica fed marshmallows to the polar bears and did not get in trouble?
Oh, yes. Not only is it possible, but I, too, have a childhood memory of throwing marshmallows to the bears. This was something people were allowed to do, not only at the Milwaukee County Zoo, but lots of zoos around the United States. And, in fact, we have skeletal evidence of that, the effect on bears. We have a black bear skull that has fillings in all of its teeth.
So it turns out this falls under the category of funny, quaint things that we used to be okay with. Filed under the same category, another zoo bear story we uncovered in a historical photograph from when the zoo used to be at Washington Park and, for a brief period, All kinds of bears were in a single enclosure.
If you're referencing the picture I think you're referencing, it's the exhibit. It was a mixed species exhibit from the 30s, in which they had grizzly bear cubs, black bear cubs, polar bear cubs, and wolf cubs. And the zoo director at the time thought if he could raise all of these animals together, they would be friends.
And this is where our story takes a dark turn that might make you uncomfortable.
What happened is the polar bear is the top predator in that group, and the polar bears drowned the black bear cubs one at a time in full view of the public. The county board did not appreciate that, and he did lose his job. It was a mistake.
But on a happier note, Jessica Oles was pretty pleased we answered her question.
Oh my gosh, I'm not crazy? This is wonderful. I'm just so thrilled to finally have a definitive answer on this. Hot dog.
So the obvious point we should make is that the zoo does not allow this anymore. Mary Kazmierczak puts it in perspective.
Marshmallows are good for s'mores, not for animals.
For Bubbler Talk, I'm Mitch Tyke.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Bubbler Talk takes us to the end of Friday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Joy and I produce the show along with Mitch Tyke and Audrey Nowakowski, intern Claudia Delgadillo, and reporter Susan Bentz.
Michelle Matanowski is the managing editor. Thanks to Willie Porter for the theme music.
And thanks to you for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. And Fresh Air is next.